Talk Radio 790 KABC. Peter Tilton at 10 continues with Rick Steves, PBS TV host, travel expert, best-selling author of quite a few books, including Travel as a Political Act, How to Leave Your Baggage Behind, and Good Morning. Rick, good to have you on.
Nice to be with you, Peter.
First off, I hate you because you're one of those guys who managed to develop a career out of something you just love, and you get to travel, and you get to tell people about it, and you get to go places that are amazing. And the thing that moved me the most in the book was your original story about when you were 14 with your parents, realizing how much they loved you, and then looking around and seeing how much other parents loved their kids because they were doing whatever they could to expose them to this huge world and to see the differences that are out there.
Yeah, I had that sort of eureka when I was 14 years old with my mom and dad in a big park in Oslo. And they were just loving me, and I was just a pill. I was just a headache for them, and they didn't have a lot of money, and they were bending over backwards to take me to Europe and compromising their travel experience so I could have that experience. And I looked around that park, and it was just dotted with families, with parents loving their kids as much as my parents loved me. And it occurred to me, this world must be home to billions of equally precious little children of God that are so lovable, you know. And for a 14-year-old to have that revelation, it was just a beautiful thing. And it's sort of, in a beautiful way, been with me ever since as I teach Americans how to travel.
Oh, I think that, and it infuses your attitude to that. I didn't get to travel till later in life because there were always some tragedies or monetary things. And when I did, it's funny, you talk about getting out of your comfort zone. The best travel I've ever had was when I'm in a city and I just walk up to some cab driver or somebody to drive me around and start talking to them about their country, their city, their problems.
Oh, yeah.
And they usually, once you engage them, they start showing you stuff and taking it places that tourists don't get to see.
Oh, that is so clear to me, Peter, that people carbonates your travel experience. And in my work now, if I'm making a TV show or if I'm writing a guidebook or leading a tour, if I'm not connecting my American travelers with real people, not a woman in a dirndl who meets the tour guide at the airport, you know, and this kind of thing, but real people, and just have a beer and talk. That's the beauty of travel. So sure, you're going to see the museums, and you're going to go to the castles, but you want to find a way to meet those people. And in so many ways, the less you spend, the more real people you meet, because you become part of the party more than part of the economy, and then you're just all in this together, and that's the magic of travel. And that's one of the themes of my book, Travel as a Political Act, is it's just great, especially in this day and age, for Americans to get out there and gain an empathy for the other 96% of humanity. I mean, the rest of the world is not going to go away, that's for sure, and we got to play ball with it. And I have found that the world is just filled with joy and love and good people, and the most fearful people in our country are those who don't get out much. You know, fear is for people who don't get out much, and the flip side of fear is understanding, and I found we gain understanding when we travel.
It's funny, I was just going to go to fear. So when you go to another country, you're with a tour group, and it's organized, and they take you here, and lunch is at noon, and then 3 o'clock you go to this, and you see the cathedral. Approaching somebody, a stranger, and saying, or a cab driver, the first thing you hear is, oh, you're going to be kidnapped, there's terrorism, like a friend in Mexico City, oh my gosh, how do I know that's the right kind of cab? Or the guy's going to be a terrorist and take me away and roll me for all my money. How do you navigate that? Because there's unfounded fear, and then there's a level of, hey, you got to be smart about certain stuff.
Oh, of course you got to be smart. And every time I get ripped off, I celebrate because they don't know who they ripped off, and I'm going to learn that lesson and take notes and put it into my book. So people who get my book and read it will know what the scam is over there. And there's a lot of scams. You're not going to get mugged or knifed. That only happens really in the United States. You're going to just get petty purse snatched or pickpocketed. And, you know, there's a lot of naive Americans who get ripped off in Europe. There's shell games. These Russian thugs with their shell games in Paris now. I can't believe people, you know, you have a shill there and he wins 50 euros and then this stupid tourist comes in and thinks they can win 50 euros and of course they get ripped off. There's just naive and silly people on the streets that encourage the scam artists. But if you're, you know, reasonably on the ball and using common sense, I think Europe is, from a physical point of view, very safe. And from a petty crime in the street point of view, yeah, it's kind of sport and you're rich and they're the street kids that are ripping you off are poor, and you know, you just got to be on the ball. But from a safety point of view, I just feel like people got to get a grip. You know, it's safe to travel. In the old days when I started traveling, Peter, people said bon voyage, now Americans say, have a safe trip. You know, I don't know where this came from, but when somebody tells me have a safe trip, I'm really inclined to say, well, you have a safe stay at home, because where I'm going is safer than where you're staying, if you believe in statistics. I know those are optional these days, but there's no question it's safer to leave this country than to stay in this country and walk on the streets of our great cities.
The book is a trip. Travel is a political act. Why don't you talk about Iran? Because you devote a chapter to Iran, and I know that in the press materials it says some of the best traveling you've had. People wouldn't necessarily book these vacations at the top of their list. Nicaragua, El Salvador, Iran, and USSR. It sounds daunting. So how do you navigate Iran, and what's the upside of going to Iran?
Well, the upside of going to Iran is kind of like the upside of going to Cuba. You're learning, you're humanizing people who are supposed to be our enemies. And you're realizing that our governments have some differences, and there's certainly some bad things going on between governments and so on. But individuals on the street are just like you and me. They've got the same concerns. They've got a sense of humor. They've got frustrations with their government. But it is challenging for Americans to go to other countries and learn to get out of our comfort zone. And, you know, I'm not saying that Cuba and Iran and Palestine and Russia are you know, going to be popular tourist destinations. I'm just saying, if you want to have transformational experience in your travels, you've got choices to make. You can go to Mazatlan or you can go to Managua. Two very different choices. They cost about the same. They're about the same in the area of risk. In other words, they're safe. And one will broaden your waistline and the other will broaden your perspective. I love going to Iran. And I went there and made a TV show. And people can watch that on public television or on my website or online. But it was so fun for me to just not go to Iran like I'm 60 Minutes looking for nuclear armaments, but go to Iran and just to understand how those people could vote for a guy like Ahmadinejad, and why do women cover their hair, and these issues that confuse Americans. And this is a way to humanize that 70 million people and to learn what is their baggage. You know, we have baggage here in the United States. That's something I deal with in my Travel as a Political Act book. We're just riddled with or burdened by 9/11 baggage. When I was little, it was what my parents had, Depression-era baggage. We had Japanese and German baggage after World War II. We had communist baggage during the Cold War, Vietnam baggage. Now we have 9/11 baggage. Well, Iran's got incursions from the West baggage, and we need to recognize that, just as we want people to recognize and respect our baggage. And when I went to Iran, I was blown away by the friendliness. Tehran is a city of, what, 12 million people or something like that. Lots of traffic jams in Tehran. I was in a traffic jam. I'll never forget it. It was just quiet. We're sitting there, and the man in the next car motioned to my driver to roll down the window, and he passed over a bouquet of flowers, and he said to the driver, give this to the foreigner in your back seat and apologize for our traffic.
Whoa.
And that was just a kind of, that never happens in Seattle. I don't know about Los Angeles, but
no, not, I've never gotten a bouquet here. But let me ask you this, Rick, because I'm sure people listening are going, yeah, but Rick, his tours are arranged. There's more protection, or there's more advance notice, and you're talking to diplomats over there. Is that accurate or not? Can somebody like me just go to Iran and have the same experience?
Yeah, going to Iran, Peter, today is like going to the Soviet Union back in communist times. They don't want you rattling around there on your own. And so you need to take a tour. You don't need to be a big shot or a TV journalist or anything like that. Just a tourist. Iran's a huge destination for Germans and Australians and Canadians. The Lonely Planet guidebook to Iran, which I used, was excellent, and it sells really well, except it doesn't sell much among Americans. Just like Cuba is the biggest Caribbean destination
right.
for Canadians and Germans, and Americans don't think you can go there. And guidebooks in English sell very well to that. But in the case of Iran, you get a visa by having a tour, because they want you to have a local guide, and they want to have your hotels figured out, and they want to make sure you're going to be okay. You're not going to get yourself into trouble by going into forbidden places, and that they just want you to have a good experience. I am not, I'm generally kind of a cynical person about people wanting to have a minder and so on, but it's reasonable in Iran for them to want Americans to have a guide and a hotel figured out in advance. Just like I think if an Iranian wanted to come to the United States, I think we'd probably keep an eye on him, too.
Yeah, no kidding. Talking to Rick Steves, the book is amazing, Travels, a Political Act. What was the biggest eye-opener for you? I mean, you've traveled everywhere. You've seen, I mean, just naming those countries, I'm sure a lot of eye-openers. But what was the one that you didn't expect in all your traveling? Because you kind of get used to surprises. What was the one that really blew you away, if there is one that sticks out?
The fun thing about travel, I've written guidebooks for the last 30 years. I've written 50 guidebooks. Most of them are guidebooks to Italy or London or Spain or whatever. But I've written a how to travel book, an art book, and my how to broaden your perspective through travel book. That's Travel as a Political Act. And it's just filled with these eye-openers. And basically, we're so ethnocentric and we don't know it. I'm a pretty well-traveled, you know, consider myself a well-educated and well-traveled, global-minded person. I'm ethnocentric. And when I go to the Indian subcontinent and I'm in a restaurant and a man sits down next to me and says, I'm a professor here and I want you to know that a third of the people on this planet eat with spoons and forks like you, a third of the people eat with chopsticks, and a third of the people eat with their fingers like I do, and we're all civilized just the same. That really has an impact. And I go, oh yeah, I did think less of you because you eat with your fingers and I eat with a spoon and a fork. But you could actually frame it in a way where it's more elegant to use your fingers for what God intended them to be used for, to nourish yourself. And people in India enjoy using their fingers, not because they can't afford a spoon or a fork or they've never been taught. They choose to use their fingers. A fancy restaurant with elegant professional people in India might have no spoons and forks and a ceremonial sink where people wash their hands and they eat that elegant way. So I don't need to go home and eat with my fingers, but it's nice to know that there are people that see that differently than me. And then that's just an example. I was on an airplane once in South Asia where there's a decal in the toilet that shows how you don't squat, you don't stand on the rim and squat over the toilet, but you actually sit on that thing, reminding me that for the average person on this planet, they don't sit on something when they go to the bathroom. I didn't realize that. Now there's simpler examples. You go to France and a lot of Americans are upset with the slow service. And they don't realize slow service is respectful service. They're not trying to turn the table. They want you to stay all night. They don't want you to go. They're right. Happy you're there. Linger. If you could speak enough words to say, excuse me, I'm in a hurry, can I have the bill now? You'd get the bill now. But a lot of Americans just fume because the service is slow, not understanding that's a beautiful thing. So there's these cultural differences. Just recently, Peter, it occurred to me, we're raised with saying the work ethic, not a work ethic, but the work ethic. But it's not the work ethic. We have the American work ethic, and that to most of the world is work too hard and deny your family time for your job. It's not right or wrong, but my Norwegian relatives don't have the work ethic. They have a Norwegian work ethic, and my Spanish friends have a Spanish work ethic. Is it good for the economy? Not necessarily in the short term anyways. Is it good for family values? They would say yes. So again, it's not right or wrong, but a beautiful thing about travel is you just humble yourself from an ethnocentric point of view and you become more tuned into the world.
Yeah, I realize when you just let go and don't try and organize your day and figure out what you're going to see, just see what you see. Mm-hmm. And I know you talk about that, like seeking out political street art. Or going, I think you mentioned in one of the materials, going to a commune in Copenhagen and just checking stuff out. And do you ping pong, like when you get to a place, do you have a set itinerary or do you talk, you go someplace and you're talking to somebody and say, you know, that's pretty cool. I'll go there. And then when you're there, you ask that person, where else should I go? Is that what motivates your trip?
Well, that's the ideal. I have to be honest, when I'm traveling, I'm working, so I've got a pretty strict schedule because I'm updating guidebooks and scouting TV shows and that kind of stuff. And when people hire me to take them around, we have a full plate where we fill every day with sightseeing. And then we get them oriented, and instead of having group dinners all the time, we turn them loose in the evening so they can have those individual adventures. But independent travelers, you hit it on the nail. The beautiful thing is just to wander with some context. When you go to Copenhagen, you know, you've got the most coordinated, life is like a jukebox in Copenhagen. Everything is so clean and everything is so orderly, but they have the opposite in their kind of hippie squatter commune, Christiania.
Right.
And to go there, you get the other side of that social story. It's a beautiful thing. When I'm in Israel, you got to go over the wall into the West Bank, into Palestine. You could bicycle from where Christians believe Jesus was born to where he was crucified in half an hour today. But for the local people in Bethlehem can't go to Jerusalem, and people in Jerusalem cannot go to Bethlehem because of that wall. We tourists can walk right through it, just like we can walk over the wall from San Diego to Tijuana and talk to people on both sides. And if you're looking for a rich travel experience, that would be a very rich travel experience.
You know what, Rick? We got about a minute left. You made me want to travel. As you're talking, I want to leave right now and go somewhere. Real quickly, any place you haven't gone that's still on the wish list?
Well, my mission in my teaching is to inspire and equip Americans to go beyond Orlando. The only guidebook in the United States that sells more than my Rick Steves Italy book is the guidebook to Disney World in Orlando. And that's La La Land. And my travel is reality travel. I love going to places where I can hang out on the beach. I love going to beautiful towns where I can have a nice cafe. But remember, you have the option to have that reality travel. And what I, you know, on my list is there's huge swaths of the world I've never been to. South America, Sub-Saharan Africa. There's lots of places I want to go to. I'm going to go to Ethiopia and Guatemala this fall for my first time in both of those countries.
Amazing.
You just get choices. It's Mazatlan or Managua.
The choice
is important.
So with 30 seconds to go and some closure on the first question I asked you, or the first thing we talked about is you as a kid, your kids travel? Have they been infected by your travel and do they get it?
You know, my kids get it. My son has his own tour company, and he organizes student adventures, weekend student adventures for Americans having foreign study programs in Europe. And my daughter teaches high school English in the core of big cities where kids need a little extra support.
Well, congratulations, Rick. It's a wonderful show. It's a terrific book. Rick Steves, Travel as a Political Act, How to Leave Your Baggage Behind. It'll open your eyes and maybe make your next trip that much more unbelievable and enjoyable. Thanks for coming on. And I should give you, it's Twitter's at Rick Steves, and the website is RickSteves, STEVES.com. Thank you, Rick, and safe travel.
Bon voyage, Peter, say bon voyage.
Bon voyage. We'll talk soon.
Okay.
All right, talk radio 790 KBC. Talk radio 790 KABC. Peter Tillon at 10 continues. You know, an amazing business you don't even think of. That is booming, and that is, well, I'll give you a hint. We had hurricanes in Puerto Rico. We had them in Florida. We had them in Houston. We've had all these heinous events, right? FEMA runs low on food rations. So what do people do? They do survival food. The survival food business is booming, apparently. The 42-year-old chief executive of one company, the Wise Company, a leading brand of survival food, says it's cooking. These Mylar pouches of freeze-dried meats, such as savory stroganoff and loaded baked potato casserole, are designed to remain edible on shelves for like 25 years. And over the past several years, it appears the prepper phenomenon, those who are preparing for either the end of the earth, an uprising, some doomsday stuff, they're gearing up. And it used to be just in the backwoods. It used to be, hey, Ma, give me one of those stroganoff dishes. Well, now you see shows like National Geographic Channel's Doomsday Prepper, and also media reports that the very rich and very worried are buying and fortifying luxury bunkers now. He's been positioning Wise to feed right into that trend. He got a call, as a matter of fact, from FEMA, and he rushed some food down there because they were running short, and he's filling up their orders. He's filled a lot of emergency orders, including supplies for Ebola victims in Liberia, for people in the Philippines devastated by 2013's earthquake. Carnival Cruise Line, remember that? They stocked with Wise pouches at its Caribbean ports to feed employees when storms rocked the regions. And just a few days before the FEMA call, the Salvation Army purchased 100,000 servings of his products for Florida shelters near areas affected by Hurricane Irma. Since 2013, when he came on as a CEO, he's been trying to move the company beyond just disaster response industry, which is really, really smart. And he's gotten into Walmart, Home Depot, et cetera. And he's doing incredibly well because, again, people were worried that something bad is going to be happening. Wise's annual retail sales have more than doubled to about $75 million. Using his network of former clients, he's persuaded Walmart, Target, Home Depot, Bed Bath & Beyond to carry his products. And he's even going to be on the Home Shopping Network to feature the company's wares. So maybe a good time to invest in the surveillance food business. And I, from my end, I don't have any disposable income. So invest means maybe I should buy some of this food, put it in my garage, and just forget about it so I have it, which makes sense, especially when you're in earthquake and fire country. If you can't get to the store or you're stuck for a week in your house and you got mouths to feed, there you go. The survival business is booming. Who knew? Talk Radio 790 KBC. Talk Radio 790 KABC. Peter Tillon at 10 continues with Lauren Zinomersky. Lauren is going to run the Boston Marathon on April 16, 2018. I'm not going to tell you how he's going to run it quite yet, but welcome to the show. How are you?
Thanks, Peter. Thanks for having me. I'm doing well this morning.
Now, you work at Disney still? Is that where you are?
Yeah, I've been at Disney for 8 years now.
And you're the guy who does legal affairs, so you do all of the clearances and the contracts and all that, and the talent agreements, right?
Yep, I work on big Disney live-action films like Beauty and the Beast was the biggest movie I've worked on so far. And, yeah, I negotiate the talent agreements.
Is that a tough thing, and are you seeing a difference already because of the Me Too movement as far as how contracts are scrutinized between male and female actors and actresses?
You know, I think we're seeing a bit of that, but, you know, my job has always been tough, and, you know, these films just get more complicated to produce because we're producing them all around the world.
Sure.
But I enjoy it. I love Disney. Disney's been great to me. It's an excellent company.
How cool is it? And how did you get into that? How, as a lawyer, do you decide I'm going to go into this entertainment law?
Well, my dad actually worked for Universal Studios for over 30 years, and so I think I was kind of raised within the studio system, and he always told me, you know, working for studios, great, they treat you well, and so that's kind of how I fell into it.
That's neat, and you're a runner, and you've also done, what kind of races? You've done Ironman, right?
I did one Ironman in 2015, and I've done, I believe, 7 marathons. Mostly all of them were the LA Marathon.
How do you prepare for an Ironman?
As best as you can. It's really tough. And at the time I had a girlfriend who's fine with me, you know, being like, okay, it's Saturday morning. I'm going to be gone for 9 hours. I'm going to go on a bike ride. And then on Sunday, I'll be gone for 4 hours for a long run. You know, it took up so much time.
But it must be an amazing accomplishment when you finish. You completed it, obviously. So that must be insane.
Oh yeah, and the Ironman I did was in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and they were having record temperatures, and it was actually 106 degrees. It had beaten the record on that day by 11 degrees, so I was so happy to finish that race.
And how much weight did you lose?
10 pounds, something like that. Jeez. Throughout the whole training.
Incredible. Yeah. And then how much time after something like that, when you put your body through something like that, does it take to regenerate and feel like you again?
I'd say about 2 weeks. So I was limping around for about 2 weeks.
Wow. Well, now you're doing the marathon, but this time, because you're going to raise money for epilepsy, you're going to do it backwards, which is I started thinking about that, and I thought, even walking backwards for a little bit is disorienting. You got to get your bearings straight. It throws off your equilibrium, and you're going to only do it for 26-plus miles. How do you prepare for that, and does it feel that much differently as far as muscle groups, as far as everything? How are you going to pull this off?
So I started running backwards last June, and I started off with just a small distance, like a half mile, and then I slowly increased the mileage every time I ran, just in tiny increments. And it was so difficult when I first started. It was literally impossible. I started second guessing, you know, my decision to try to break the world record for the fastest marathon run backwards. But slowly and surely, my body got used to it. And now I'm running, you know, 14 miles backwards at a time. And I think
where do you do it? Do you do it on a track or are you out in the public?
I either do it on the treadmill, which I've learned is, you know, the safest place for me to do it because there's no obstacles. Plus also, I don't have to look behind me, you know, turning my head and getting that sore neck. So it kind of allows me to zone out, a little bit more. But if I'm outside running, I generally do it around Griffith Park. There's a big golf course and horse trail that goes around it. And I found that that's a nice, safe area. There's not really many obstacles, not too many people. So anyone listening out there, if you've seen some guy running backwards around Griffith Park, I'm assuming that's me.
I hope you get a lot of coverage. I hope you raise a lot of money. Uphill or downhill worse backwards?
Is worse uphill by far. Yeah. Oh man. It's hard.
we'll be watching. I got to go to the site and check out the running. Everybody else, it's bostonbackwards.com. It's for the Epilepsy Foundation right here in Los Angeles. It helps a lot of people. And Lauren's attempting to go for the world record. We'll be following it April 16th, 2018. Hopefully we'll have you on after, and we can celebrate.
Yeah. Hopefully I'll be, a world record holder at, you know, when I come back on.
You got it, Lauren. Lauren Zinnemerski. Attempting to break the record for the fastest backward marathon at the 2018 Boston Marathon, bostonbackwards.com. Thanks, Lauren.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks for having me on.
Talk Radio 790 KBC. Mexican Coke. Ready? A lot of millennials, a lot of folks like Mexican Coke, and I know where your brain just went to cartels, right? No, I'm talking about Coca-Cola. Foodies and soda lovers say that there's a huge difference between Coke made with sugar and Coke made with high fructose corn syrup. So a lot of people want to buy Coke, as the classic 1970 ad goes, to make the world sing, but they want to buy Mexican Coke. first, the bottle's sexy. It's a more curvaceous bottle that seems more appealing. But Coca-Cola is the, how do you pronounce it, David? Hecho, Hecho in Mexico, how would you say that? Hecho?
Hecho.
Hecho. Hecho. It contains cane sugar rather than high fructose corn syrup. And that is currently the whipping boy of the food world. Hipsters, trendy restaurants, know all about Mexican Coke from some time now. And the bodegas in Los Angeles have stocked it to appeal to the Mexican-American consumers. Do Mexican-Americans like the Coke down there more than they like the Coke up here, you think, David?
Si.
Absolutely. got an unequivocal uh-huh. But in recent years, Mexican Coke has been appearing in the wine aisles of Costco, signaling a broader interest. So now, you know what? Now, all of a sudden, I want to do this. The American Enterprise, a new exhibition at the National Museum of American History, features the slender glass bottle, and the curator says there's more to the story of Mexican Coke than a simple preference for one kind of sweetener over the other. Mexico and the United States have been engaged in a trade war over sugar. Sugar's a big business in Mexico, as it is in a lot of the world. So in an effort to protect its sugar industry, Mexico has repeatedly tried to inhibit imports of high fructose corn syrup, which the U.S. has been exporting to Mexico and has been used in place of Mexican sugar to make Coke, as well as other products. And in 97, the Mexican government passed a levy on high fructose corn syrup in an attempt to keep the demand and the price for Mexican sugar higher. The U.S. said this is an unfair infringement on trade and went to the World Trade Organization to make its case, and the World Trade Organization decided in favor of the U.S. Coke, that is HO in Mexico, contains cane sugar rather than high fructose corn syrup, which is currently, like I said, looked down upon. In 2002, Mexico tried again, enacting a new law calling for a tax on the use of high fructose corn syrup in the soda industry. Once again, the U.S. went to the WTO, and the organization again ruled in favor of the U.S. So cane sugar workers in small Mexican villages being forced out of business shouldn't have to compete with American prices, but situation more complicated than that. Although there's some small landholders making a living, Mexican agriculture today is very much a remnant of the hacienda system before. So it's a war that continues between us and Mexico, and it's all for their Coke. And it ain't the Coke that's controlled by cartels. It's the Coke that's controlled by all of this high fructose corn syrup. So now what I'm going to do as soon as I get off is I got to try Mexican Coke. Eat your Coke right after this. Talk Radio 790 KBC. Mexican Coke. Ready? A lot of millennials, a lot of folks like Mexican Coke, and I know where your brain just went to cartels, right? No, I'm talking about Coca-Cola. Foodies and soda lovers say that there's a huge difference between Coke made with sugar and Coke made with high fructose corn syrup. So a lot of people want to buy Coke, as the classic 1970 ad goes, to make the world sing, but they want to buy Mexican Coke. First, the bottle's sexy. It's a more curvaceous bottle that seems more appealing, but Coca-Cola is the... How do you pronounce it, David? Hecho, Hecho in Mexico. How would you say that? Hecho?
Hecho.
Hecho. Hecho. It contains cane sugar rather than high fructose corn syrup. And that is currently the whipping boy of the food world. Hipsters, trendy restaurants, know all about Mexican Coke from some time now. And the bodegas in Los Angeles have stocked it to appeal to the Mexican-American consumers. Do Mexican-Americans like the Coke down there more than they like the Coke up here, you think, David?
Si.
Absolutely. got an unequivocal uh-huh. But in recent years, Mexican Coke has been appearing in the wine aisles of Costco, signaling a broader interest. So now, you know what? Now, all of a sudden, I want to do this. The American Enterprise, a new exhibition at the National Museum of American History, features the slender glass bottle, and the curator says there's more to the story of Mexican Coke than a simple preference for one kind of sweetener over the other. Mexico and the United States have been engaged in a trade war over sugar. Sugar's a big business in Mexico, as it is in a lot of the world. So in an effort to protect its sugar industry, Mexico has repeatedly tried to inhibit imports of high fructose corn syrup, which the U.S. has been exporting to Mexico and has been used in place of Mexican sugar to make Coke, as well as other products. And in 97, the Mexican government passed a levy on high fructose corn syrup in an attempt to keep the demand and the price for Mexican sugar higher. The U.S. said this is an unfair infringement on trade and went to the World Trade Organization to make its case, and the World Trade Organization decided in favor of the U.S. Coke, that is HO in Mexico, contains cane sugar rather than high fructose corn syrup, which is currently, like I said, looked down upon. In 2002, Mexico tried again, enacting a new law calling for a tax on the use of high fructose corn syrup in the soda industry. Once again, the U.S. went to the WTO, and the organization again ruled in favor of the U.S. So cane sugar workers in small Mexican villages being forced out of business
shouldn't have to compete with American prices, but situation more complicated than that. Although there are some small landholders making a living, Mexican agriculture today is very much a remnant of the hacienda system before. So it's a war that continues between us and Mexico, and it's all for their coke. And it ain't the coke that's controlled by cartels. It's the coke that's controlled by all of this high fructose corn syrup. So now what I'm going to do as soon as I get off is I got to try Mexican coke. Eat your coke right after this. Talk Radio 790 KBC.